Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello, a warm welcome to everyone to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as I do every week when we're having a show, I'm going to take us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, as I like to say, rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, let me open with a hearty and healthy happy year, new year to everyone on this third day of 2011. New Year's Day plus two since Auld Lang Syne, and I must say it is the same number of days since I heard some nostalgic music by Neil Young over the weekend, New Year's Day in particular, both via the days of his time with Buffalo Springfield and his days with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And it brought to mind to me a time when I heard Neil Young being asked, "Why do so many of your songs sound alike?" And he responded, "Because they're really all one song." And I think that's a great entree to Zoom today. It's a pointer to the larger view, certainly, that on Zoomed we have overall. On Zoomed, we're really about a vast one of an intersecting world and consciousness. And in particular today, it's about all one crisis when we consider the larger view of where we are in the world and the sovereign debt crisis that is a clear backdrop to our realities. So today, my discussion, the sovereign debt crisis, is the subject of our show. Our show title is All One Crisis. And today, what I really hope to do is to paint a picture of realities we're living into and we'll be facing, and how we can progress in this era of great and extraordinary change by anticipating the future, by monitoring, seeing what actually occurs as we go, and adjusting. And that is just the way we do it as investors. And I think we're going to try to do that today as we kick off the show. But the show overall really continues our theme that I started two shows ago. We did a show on what we called the deficit blues. We started talking about here in the U.S. the blues relative to our deficit and debt. And last week we talked about the quiet coup, and both of which were about the contributions that really they have made to the sovereign debt crisis and that we find ourselves in today and that we're going to be living into. But today, though, I want to take a few steps back. I want to take a few steps actually higher on the balcony at the same time, and I like to bring those shows forward, and I'd like to connect the dots on where we've both been, where we are now in light of the debt crisis, and where we seem to be heading with some anticipation. But I got to say, as we open, it does seem rather contradictory as the stock market today has taken off in the new year. It's likely heading for a strong leg of a major correction coming our way in the market as we get into the year. But it has the prospects of a very good year in the market. But it seems to be perhaps an interesting one and timely for us to think about. Amidst that, we're going to be talking about the sovereign debt crisis and where it might be heading. But let me start today with an analogy, perhaps a picture, and perhaps a timely one given the recent cold and the snowy weather that we've been experiencing here in Europe and here in the U.S. and, I think, in Europe. And the analogy is this. It is about a car that's going very fast, and it's traveling on a windy evening on a winding winter road at really substantial speed. The road is very icy. The temperature is well below freezing, although the car is warm and cozy inside, soft music playing, and the car is entering a solid patch of black ice. And it begins to skid, begins to slide. You can begin to sense the driver is beginning to steer and brake, do what needs to be done, do what can be done. But the visibility on the turn he's coming into or she is coming to is foggy and unclear. You can begin to feel the sense of it. You can feel the car moving forward. It is going fast. You can begin to actually get the feeling yourself of what it's like when you've been on ice and felt the skid and the slide beginning to come. You can actually even almost feel it in your stomach, the little grip in your stomach at the base of it as you lose contact of the tires on the pavement. And a bit just this dynamic, as you actually have that picture in your mind, take a freeze frame. Take a photo in your mind. Stop the action. Frame it and see what you see on that car, on that turn, heading into the bend. And I'd say what you probably see, it looks fine outwardly in that freeze frame. You see the patch, but it's not obvious. You see the car and its signs, it signals, no damage, nothing happening, looks fine going straight. It's like the market is today. People in the car may look a little concerned, but they're not panicked. And what you also don't see is the ditch down the road, the small, perhaps limited, low-level guardrail, and the ravine that's upcoming even beyond the ditch and the big vertical fall that's beyond the rail. That is an analogy. That is perhaps a reasonable picture of, I think, where we are today with the sovereign debt reality. And I think it's going to become more clear over the course of the show and our conversation that Fed Chairman Bernanke and other elected leaders, as well as most of us, are actually seeing this freeze frame. And I think they're monitoring the signs and they're communicating to us that all is fine. But I think I'm going to paint a picture of what this movement, what this skid, what this black ice, where it could be heading to us, what we're trying to do as a country and as a Fed and across the world to try to really manage, drive, and steer, and what are the options we have in doing so. But from a larger frame and from a dynamic systems analysis perspective, it doesn't really take rocket science. It doesn't actually even take a crystal ball to suggest that the scene on the ice is heading to perhaps a tenuous and maybe even a less than happy ending. And that's part of what I want to point to. That's what I want to anticipate today. And what I want to do is take that analogy to begin with and to make sense of it. I'd like to sort of put together the dynamics at play, a parallel to the study of the ice, parallel to the steering, parallel to the braking systems, the momentum, the visibility, and as much as we can to give us a sense of where we are in this crisis, what is being done, where is all this heading. And today I hope I really want to make some sense of the complexity to you, and I really want to pull together some of the bits and drabs that come together we see in the media and try to put together the picture of how that all might work. So, but perhaps the first question you can ask as we start even talking about this, why is this a bad scene? Why am I even referring to this as a bad scene brewing? The market's good, not necessarily a problem on the ice. What evidence is there to suggest that we have a serious situation that we're anticipating? And I think, and I would say to you, I think that's a fair question. I think it's absolutely a fair question. And perhaps it's not only a question about the car, but more importantly, what is it about this economic crisis that actually may have that kind of concern to it? And to answer it, maybe I'm not going to give you any empirical data, but let me give you a sense of some of the others and some of the signs and some of the people that are actually paying attention to it. And to do that, I'd like to even suggest that over the last 3 years, maybe we can point to our U.S. military and to their focus on national security. And if we really even look at the mainstream media, take CNBC as an example. I do follow it myself. And here in the U.S., folks, those of you in Europe, you may get it, but you may not. It's an outlet on cable. It is our mainstream business. But they have been reporting since 2009 about the economic war games being staged by the Pentagon, which have included the U.S., many other factors, and China in particular, all of which about an economic Cold War. The U.S. Army, if you begin to even follow this track, has been conducting and has it really even on the agenda as we speak, the Unified Quest 2011, which is a wargaming series. It's studying the implications of large-scale economic breakdown. Interesting, huh? It's been reported on CNBC and others that there's some several concerns they're looking at, one of which is around sovereign wealth funds and how they may manipulate the markets and currencies. Well, okay, that's one to think about. Two, but they're examining the nation-state economic collapse scenarios, the sovereign defaults that may trigger them, and the ensuing nation-state instability. That's a big one for our conversation today. And three, they're looking at not only our own debt and deficits, they're looking at our allies, the budgets, the national security infrastructure, all of that coming together and how that might actually play out. In essence, they're studying how the large-scale economic breakdowns could force the Army to provide domestic order amid civil unrest. That's part of the backdrop of this. That's part of the seriousness of the conversation. And they're also looking at how they're going to deal with dramatically reduced budgets themselves. There's all kinds of things going on. They're sending people to work from the War College to Wall Street to look into this. But I think we might answer this a question about importance, and as it perhaps it might even be best reflected over the last 3 years by a combination of Admiral Mullen and Admiral Denny Blair here in the U.S. Denny Blair is the Director of National Intelligence, who have both gone before the U.S. Congress and said bluntly, economic threats are the biggest risk to U.S. security. Let me say that again. Economic threats are the biggest risks to U.S. security. And if that means a risk in the U.S., it also means that's a risk to all of us in a globally connected world. So the biggest economic problem that we're going forward with out of that context really is this sovereign debt crisis. It's the level of the debt in the world, and I think it is, and I think the show is that we're really beginning to talk about here today, and will continue with others, is about and hopefully revealing the level of debt that can't be directly or simply repaid. So today what I'm going to try to do is start to bring a summary of this situation to the table. And I'm going to offer you, I think, what I consider to be somewhat of a layman's synthesis of this. This is not my expert area. I'm going to draw upon past Zoomed guests. In particular, I'm going to bring into the conversation the work and views of James R. Rickards, who is the Senior Managing Director and Head of Market Intelligence for Omnis Corporation, which is a technical, professional, and scientific consulting firm that really deals with the dynamic systems analysis viewpoints that you can put on something like what we're talking about, going beyond just the economic logic that we get out of our business schools and our economic training that's out there. And I think James has also been involved in the war gaming exercises, and I think that and my contact and really exposure to the work and presentations he's been making recently, I think it offers a viewpoint that I know is agreed upon and can be talked about by other economists and guests that we're engaged with. So that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to get started here in a moment. I hear the music in the backdrop in my ear. Let's get started. James is going to be invited to the show as we get going, but as I have been doing, I really wanted to kickstart with some summary perspectives on this, so we get some ground bed for the future conversations, just as I have done the last two shows. Let's take a break, come back. Let's get started. What is this all about? Take a break. Thanks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Class is in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back here we are, all one crisis. Our focus, the sovereign debt crisis, the picture, anticipating the future, trying to understand this while things are moving well. So let's get started. How do we get to this point? How did we actually get to this point of skidding on the black ice? Well, in summary, I think three main contributors, and that's what we've been talking about over the last couple of shows as well. The first is the runaway fiscal spending over the last 50 years. We've talked about that in our show on deficit blues. We're spending without compensating and bringing any reductions in what we're doing into any other areas. It's been a one-way street in terms of the growth. That's number one. Second, we really added to it with the fiscal stimulus that was generated in our last crisis to stimulate the economy, trying to sidestep the depression that we were envisioning. We put more large debt on the radar screen, and we added to that with the administration and the Obamacare and so forth that we have. So we have the second piece, which is about the fiscal stimulus. And the third piece, we talked about the second and this third piece on our last show, which is the show around the banks and the financial institutions and what's going on, and that is the massive substitution of public debt for private debt, how it's actually been transferred, the way that the banks who have to be saved are propped up by the government, whether it be here or in Ireland, as was the case. The government then comes in, props it up. In the case of Ireland, we actually see that the country ends up on the edge of default themselves. And then you have, in the case of Europe, a European consortium who comes in, the Central Bank Stabilization Fund, the IMF, and other support. But essentially, you haven't solved the problem. You've moved the money from one bucket, the debt from one bucket to another. It's exacerbating the crisis. But A plus B plus C, 1, 2, 3, that's what you've really been putting together in this massive amount of debt. But how do you get out of it? How do you actually repay the debt? Well, you can do it through growth, and you can do it through deleveraging, which means let's get rid of the debt. But the question becomes, I think you have to even start with the starting point as we did and we were talking about on the show 2 weeks ago, which is how much is our debt? What is our debt level? And to get to that, we've talked about it, that we have a gross domestic product. It's what we produce as a country, the goods and services, the value created, and we have a debt at three times that. GDP at $14 trillion, the debt at $42 trillion. Jeez, but that's private and public debt combined. So we got it three times the debt, but that is grossly understated. We added, as we talked about before, the other liabilities, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. You add it together, you got $100 trillion in total. It's where we are now. How do you actually pay that off? Well, the question is, you try to pay it off through growth. And you do that in growth, and you get the taxes. You view that as an expanding pie. You try to generate the revenues needed and so forth to do that. But do we really have the capacity to do that? I would say that Rickards brought the conversation to bear in the presentations and in the writings recently that reinforce what we've talked about with Chris Martins and others here. And that is, we're beyond the tipping point. No combination of growth and taxes, no linear programming ways you can look at that, can actually get that done. And that doesn't even include, as Chris Martins and Richard Heinberg has put in, how do you add to the equation the governor on the carburetor of growth that says you can't do it because our energy isn't there to be able to get the growth we need out of the economy. So Rickards is actually even bringing forward the initial financial analysis to say that no combination of growth and taxes can get us there. It's beyond ideology. You can't get there from here. That's been part of our conversation on Zoomed. But part of the conversation today is going to be about, given that you can't get there from here, how do you adjust? What do you actually do? And that's part of what we need to be to understand about it. But the second piece I mentioned around deleveraging, just to put that to the wayside, you can reduce the debt, you can cut, but what actually happens in that process? It depresses spending, and without the consumption, you don't really get the growth you need, so that's really not going to get it there. That whole process is suppressing the nature of the growth and your ability to get it out of it. So what we find is our starting point here. The big news reinforcement, I think, that we've been talking about on Zoomed for some time. The economy, energy, environment together, but in particular, we're talking about the economy and the financial system. The tipping point has been passed. The assumption underpinning our economy that growth, and especially growth in an era of cheap oil, or the era of the end of cheap oil, is in question. We can either kick the can down the road, but ultimately we have to deal with it. So the next question becomes then, how do you deal with it? How, if the debt can't be repaid by growth or deleveraging alone, how do you actually go about doing this? And that's really what I think the conversation points us to here, that we've got some options on how to get there, and we have some options and some perspectives on how to do that, but how can it be repaid? How do you get out of it? How do you actually move beyond the debt and the situation we're talking about? Well, the first thing that you can begin to talk about is outright default. And I think there's three big options as I see it, as a layman looking at this. It's three big options on how you get out of the situation. The first one is you default on it as Iceland did, that we've seen in recent years. And it actually occurred also in other times, post-World War I in the 20s and 30s. None of the debt was repaid, and that led to the deflationary collapse. We saw the Germans who owed reparations. We saw France and England who actually borrowed from us. And then President Hoover in our country declared a moratorium on war debts in 29. Essentially, defaults were actually occurring. That's actually what occurred in Iceland. That's option one, outright default. It's happened before. Can happen again. We're trying to avoid that for sure. Second is the level of what I might call confiscatory taxation. In other words, tax the heck out of everybody, take everybody's money, 90% tax, and use that to pay off the debt. Huge consequences. That's one, a conversation or a show on itself. I can't see that actually happening very significantly here in the U.S. The backlash would be immense. And the third option is what you might call an inflationary default. In other words, you print money, you experience hyperinflation, and in essence, you pay it off, but the good luck, the money's not worth much. And that's part of where our conversation really goes today, to really point to what is going on, what are the options on the table, what is it that's happening here, particularly the U.S. and even moreover around the world. So essentially, how does this actually even occur? It really is all one crisis. It is a matter of time before we find out how the chips will really play out in this situation. But in the meantime, we've got a world living into this. We have a world living into this skid. And I think it's interesting and useful to understand what is going on in the meantime, because it's providing the backdrop, providing the momentum and the emphasis and a sense of the realities we're living into. So where are we now? And let me just provide a picture of that, because I think there's three or four pieces that add to this, that we know we can't repay it, and there's the track and what is actually happening. Well, the first is, this happens, this is part of the system of what happens in times like this, and that is we're amidst currency wars. Well, what do you mean by that, John? Well, this is what happens. When we start to go into this world of low growth, we see a shrinking pie in terms of growth. Everybody starts fighting over the crumbs. Everybody starts to try to get an edge on everybody else. And you say, well, why is that? Well, is there some logic behind that, or is it just this human nature? And I'd say it's probably a combination of both, but there is logic behind it. If I go back to my days in graduate school myself, if you look at the gross domestic product, GDP, you look at what the goods and services are made of, and they're a function of four major elements. One is consumption, a second is investment, a third is government spending, and a fourth is net exports. The difference between exports and imports, the net gain you have on that. So what we actually have here is we have consumption that's declining or flat, partly because of the personal deleveraging, people trying to get their own debt taken care of. Second, we have some investment, but it's generally flat. It's building, but why would a lot of companies and others put a whole lot of money into investment when those that are the spenders aren't really spending and they're deleveraging and don't know if there's money? So we're having some there. Government, well, we've been spending there, but we haven't been getting the payback out of that. That's a conversation I can have on the Keynesian multiplier. So you're not getting consumption. You're not necessarily getting investment. You're not getting growth out of the stimulus that you're looking for. Where do you get it? You get it out of net exports. When consumption, investment, government spending aren't getting it done, you get it there. And how do you get exports up? You debase and you devalue your currency So your goods are less expensive on the world market, and the demand for them goes up. And that's what we're seeing, folks. That's what's actually happening. The problem is everybody cuts against everybody else. You can't debase against Mars. This is what happened in the Great Depression as well. So the source of growth becomes currency wars. Unfortunately, the advantage is temporary. The escalation of it's inevitable. All kinds of capital controls or other kinds of things can be brought into bear. You can bring your money in, but you can't get it out. Leads to trade wars, leads to all kinds of dynamism. But essentially, that's part of what is going on here. And remember that. The currency wars links into other parts of our conversation and where we're going. So in the meantime, that's part one. Part two, what are we getting? We're getting backlashes on the bailouts. That's what we talked about in our show last time. And it's instructive to actually even consider the nature of the bailouts and what's happening. And you might consider this from two perspectives, the pay me now or pay me later perspective. And I won't go into all the detail, but I think we have an instructive, interesting case to look at, and that is the difference between Iceland and Ireland. Iceland actually defaulted on their debt. They left their debt behind. That became the creditors' problems. They went through a great deal of pain, but in essence, ultimately, their net worth went up. The pain in the country was great. But what you find today, they've come off the bottom. Tourism's up. Exports are up. Employment is growing. It's moving. Contrast that to Ireland, who did not actually do it. They've kicked it down the road. They've been bailed out. The debts were not written off. They're actually even going so far as to removing a great deal of the democracy in terms of elections. The austerity is everywhere. They're kicking the can down the road, and it's a painful process. It's an interesting one for us to think about in terms of anticipating the future. Are we paying ourselves now, paying for it now? Are we paying it later? Does it get worse? How does that actually play out? And so in the meantime, the third element of it is what we call the quantitative easing. Nice term, isn't it? It is about printing money. And this is perhaps one of the biggest tectonic clashes that's really going on, which revolves around this printing of the money and the underpinning clash of, are we going to get and are we getting deflation? Are we getting inflation? It's like two forces underpinning that's not shaking now. You can say, well, California's not shaking, but underneath the surface, there's two tectonic plates at play. That's where I want to pick up when we come back in just a moment. Take a break, back on Zoomed, continue the conversation. All one crisis and actually all one opportunity. Back in a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
It's football, pop culture, and everything in between. Get ready for The Game Plan with Anthony Herron, a.k.a. Big Ant. Anthony has a background in college and professional football and brings the player, coach, and broadcaster perspective to this weekly roundup of the top sports news and events. Big Ant wants to hear from you, too. Tune in to The Game Plan with Anthony Herron every Tuesday afternoon at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific. Time on the Voice America Sports Channel. It's game time.
These
these days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom today. We're talking about All One Crisis. We're talking about this really as a backdrop to our leadership, to the nature of our own involvement, to preparing our own lives for what might be coming, but also to engage and to be prepared with thought processes about how do we engage and facilitate our leadership in our communities. Because the backdrop of where this might be heading, I think, is one for us to be very, very aware of. It may be one of the major issues of our times. So that's the context, but I think that where I left this is this tectonic clash, and I know as I've always engaged over the last 2 years with economists, I've always asked the question, so what about deflation? What about inflation? If I know which one it's going to be, I'll know how to personally invest. I'll know how to suggest to others how to invest. We'll know how to do this. Two forces, how do you actually do it? Because there are two natural forces. You've got the natural deflation and contraction that comes with this amount of debt and trying to work that debt down in whatever way, the deleveraging and the depression that actually was experienced at one point in time with it. And at the other side of it, you have, as I was describing, this policy-induced inflation, this printing of money and printing trillions of dollars. And while we look at what we have with inflation here in the United States at this point, we actually see that it's close to zero. It's not very much. Our producer price index, consumer price index, our price deflator, which is the favorite of Bernanke, all are not showing any indications. So it begins to ask the question of which will it be, what's really going on, and which path will it be? And essentially, I think you can boil it down to one of two scenarios from where we are here. One is the deflationary scenario, that while here in the United States in particular and around the world, but here in particular in the U.S., we're embarking on the printing of money. We've had quantitative easing 1. We've had QE 2. Many suggest that we could have 3 and 4 on this. Rickards clearly does. The question becomes, can the Fed maintain this, or are they going to get cold feet? Will the criticism get so great because the program's unsuccessful? Will there be a political backlash out of the Republicans in the administration that's actually coming forward? And the question becomes, if that's the case, if there is a backlash and they don't print, then we're going to see more deflation taking over. We're going to see some hard times coming back. But the Fed is doing the opposite. They're not giving up on that. They're actually working the other direction. The Fed is actually propping things up. And in many ways, this is propped up in some respects, as I think Rickards would describe it, as a quantum of pain when you've gone through a process like we have. And that is, over the period of time and during the big run-up in the decade before our crash, we had such low interest rates that people were making investments in things that just couldn't hold water. They couldn't carry the cost, basically, to have it done. And essentially what we're doing is we're really, really trying to push away and move beyond and not engage the pain that actually has to be done. You actually have to then write down, remove, or destroy those things that don't produce, get them to the true value of it. And it's not being done anywhere, or at least not being done to a great extent. We have banks with what we might call mortgages in rot on the balance sheets that aren't being written down, that are being held there many percent above what they're actually worth. And we're shifting both the losses in time, meaning we're trying to push these losses out, but we're actually shifting, as we've been talking about, who loses them, who actually is taking the loss, the public now taking them. They're all still there, but they're being propped up. We propped up the taxpayer credits for home buyers to try to keep the housing prices up. We're beginning to see that they're coming back down. We've talked about it on this show, that bubbles occur. They actually have to go back to where they started or correct below that. That says we've got another 30% to go. But essentially, that we are in the midst of this process of things being propped up, printing money and what we're doing. The Fed wants inflation. That's the second scenario. Inflationary scenario, the inflationary perspective, that's where we're really finding ourselves. And there's a logic behind that. Because if you think about it, if you have 4% inflation over 17 years, it cuts the value of the debt in real terms in half. And if that were the case, we might actually be able to pay that off. But this whole exercise is about inflation. And it's contingent on being able to control inflation like a thermostat. The amount up, the amount down, trying to dial it in, dial it up, dial it into the right amount. But here is the critical issue in complex systems, because they're incredibly complex and they can't quickly and easily be managed that way. You quickly get into tipping points, you quickly get into critical thresholds that can't be managed well. The Fed and the government seems that they can control this. If not, the result will be hyperinflation, hyperinflation, and get that word out there, and collapse potentially of the value of the dollar, certainly reducing that. And that's part of the conversation. The reason that we're having the Fed do what they're doing is they want inflation. But the question becomes, why aren't we getting it? If that's the chosen route, why aren't we really getting what we're trying to do? And the reason is China. In effect, China is importing our inflation. Let me say that again. They're importing our inflation. In effect, they have outsourced their monetary policy to the U.S. And they're doing this because their exchange rate mechanism, the way it's put together, their exchange rate is pegged to our dollar, pegged in a fixed rate of the yuan to the dollar. It's not allowing it to rise. They want cheap currency, as I mentioned. But in return, as we print dollars, China has to flood their own system with their own currency to absorb our dollars. So in essence, what we're experiencing now, the Fed is trying to break the peg, trying to get China to choke on the dollars so they're going to raise interest rates and revalue the currency, at which point inflation would begin to rise here and we would be getting what we're trying to get. This, my friends, and as I'm reading the tea leaves here, this is a high-stakes game of chicken, as James Rickards would talk about it, between the U.S. and China, and you can begin to see why the Pentagon has been wargaming the economic situation here. Because the problem has a real tension point, and that is China has the peg set to keep the growth they need to support the 25 million people that are coming in from the countryside to the cities on an annual basis. They need the competitive exports. They need to keep the peg. They need to keep the growth. They need the jobs. They need to keep political stability. They'll do that through price controls and others. Or if they lose the peg and they reduce inflation, they begin to lose jobs, lose stability. They're really trying to manage a fine line that's really going on there. So that's one of the main reasons that we're not getting the inflation that we are really trying to tune up to really bring this debt actually down to something that is in terms that we might be able to manage. The second is that there's an element here at play about the monetarists and the way they look at the money supply and what's actually happening. I won't go into all the details of it, but there is, as many of us would recognize, if we're trying to swim in a river and we're trying to swim upstream, we actually have a process where we're running against the current here as well. And that is the money supply, the gross amount of money, times the how many times that it turns over, called the velocity, equals prices times real growth. It's kind of put together an equation. But in essence, the Milton Friedman of the 50s and the and 60s and 70s and 80s, who was the forerunner of saying this velocity is constant. What we find is it's dynamic. It's not constant. In fact, it's going down, which means we got to print more money just to keep the gross domestic product, just to keep the growth, just to keep the real growth in our economy going, even for what it is today. So we're printing to do that, and we're printing for inflation. And then you got the question of, with all this printing, are we stable enough? And there's a whole conversation that when we get Rickards on the show, I'd like to talk about, and that is, can the Fed, can our government, and what's happening here, but particularly the Fed, can they go belly up? Can they go broke? They're taking on trillions in liabilities. They're buying not very good assets, bad mortgages, the issues of Bear Stearns. They're doing all kinds of things, but is there a real possibility of bankrupt Fed? That's a question that certainly I have. But I think the larger question is, where is all this leading? And I think what I would summarize in what we're trying to point to is that the avenue out is inflation. The avenue out is trying to create a dollar that is valued less in all the ways that I've mentioned. And ultimately, the question revolves around, can these thresholds be managed? Will we engage tipping points as we try to manage this thermostat of inflation? It's a precarious situation. Rickards and others suggest, no, it actually can't be done. These systems are so complex, they can't be managed that way. And he suggests that the impact of all of this is a huge, huge hit on the dollar, on the value of the dollar. In fact, he suggests that we're going to see printing happen with, as I mentioned, quantitative easing number 3 and 4, and more and more will do this until it actually gets done, and that, in fact, he expects that we'll get to hyperinflation and actually at some point a dollar collapse. So that really starts to put together what we really might see here. There's a chain reaction about what might happen to get there. There's some contributing elements to it. But I'd like to paint the picture of this, at least to have in the reality of what's there. But also, in the last segment, I want to point to you what I think, what many would call is, what is the silver bullet behind the scenes here that might be there? What is the secret weapon that we're not even thinking about, or at least that might be at hand? That's where I want to bring to light on the last segment. Take a break, come back. Last segment here on Zoom. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
Tune in every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time for The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. On the show, Aldana and some of today's top business professionals will discuss some of today's most pressing business issues that hold you, the business owner, back. Aldana will also give you 21 ways to grow with her list of growth strategies. Grow smart, grow profit, and grow your business with Aldana Ambler and The Growth Strategist every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time, right here on The Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, last segment here on Zoomed. I've been pointing to this, where is this all leading? I think part of the conversation about the inflation, about trying to get us out this way, is about the risk to the dollar, the risk to the value of what we have our investments in at this point in time. And it happens quickly. And I'd suggest to you that it happens quickly. It's a lot like when we go to the movie theater. And we're sitting in a full theater, and if two or three or five people started to get up, you would think, ah, they didn't like the film, they're kind of moving on. But you actually engage, just like in the theater, there are thresholds. If those five people turn to 20 people, you'll start to think, what do they know that I don't know? Those 20 people turn to 50 people in the theater, and then people, you're beginning to think, wait a minute, somebody knows something big, and I need to get on the bandwagon here. So what happens is each time you see more and more people pull away of the theater, that's like what would happen with this dynamic of the dollar and the collapse. It's a precarious situation that it's like a chain reaction with people repudiating the dollar and actually pulling out. The value and the fall of the dollar happening rather quickly. It's an awful lot of dynamics. There's an awful lot behind it. But in essence, I think that for all of us, we need to be aware of this dynamic of deflation and inflation, the route we're taking on inflation, and what the ultimate impact of that might be. We need to prepare ourselves personally and to consider the implications of this on our organizations. We need to be able to hedge our bets. We need to anticipate, and then we need to monitor to see what's happening. But as I said, in the last coming into this last segment, there's a question here. This is all bad news. Is there any good news? Is there perhaps a window on something that might really be going on? Is there another element involved that we need to at least to recognize? And this is the one that I want to close with because I think it was an interesting one to put on the table, not because it brings such positive benefit and value. There's an awful lot of pain likely to come with it, but it is a trump card for the United States. And that is, it is around gold. And it's an extremely powerful economic secret weapon, I think, here. When we think about the United States in particular, we are the Saudi Arabia of the gold world. There are about 30,500 metric tons of gold in the world. We've got over 8,000 of them. Two-thirds of the world's gold is in friendly hands. Europe, United States, combined with the International Monetary Fund, which we've provided a lot to. But in essence, we have 8,000 tons. Other affiliated countries that are more close to our way of thinking, Germany, 3,000, IMF, 2,900, Italy, 2,000, France, 2,400, China, only 1,000, Japan, 700, plus Russia, 668. We are really in a very unique position in that. We are no longer, as you all know, on a gold standard, but James Rickards makes the case that there is 7,000 years of history on the side of gold as money. And I'm bringing this into the equation here because there are two times in the U.S. previously when we have come close to destroying the dollar. One was in the Revolutionary War, had to do with the Continentals. Second was in the Civil War, it had to do with the greenbacks. Both times we got through it and went back on a gold standard. I don't really want to get here into the discussion about whether a gold standard is appropriate or not. There are options beyond that. There are sustainability perspectives about putting together a basket of goods and perspective that you manage currency through. But here I think that we have what we might want to consider an end game, so to speak. In the end, the devaluation numeraire, the one of last resort, is potentially gold. You can devalue against a gold standard. So, for example, if we don't get the inflation we want, if ultimately there's a dollar collapse, if ultimately there is an end game of a shock and awe in the world of very, very difficult situations and circumstances, and the monetary system is in absolute chaos, you can ultimately go back onto a gold standard. You can devalue against that gold standard to the tune of $5,000 to an ounce of gold. In other words, you're repricing everything. And to add credence to that, you can begin to actually see that the United States back in the 70s created some dictatorial powers for the President of the United States back in 1977 and what was doing, in this case, that what the dictatorial powers could be done if the case were to be so bad that we could use our 8,000 tons, we could confiscate the 6,000 tons of gold that are at the bottom of the New York Fed that are owned by the rest of the world. That would give us 14,000 tons. We could actually start a new global currency. We could get the economy moving again. If the dollar collapses, Plan B is gold. We start the system. We own the majority or a huge percentage of it. That's the position. That is a position of power that we are in. So to put it all together, as we start to wind down here with this picture, that we have debt, as I started with, that can't be repaid. One way to pay it is to debase the currency. And how do you debase the currency? You do it through inflation. But we're not getting inflation because it's being exported to China. We're in a currency war with China, and we're actually, at this point, we're losing. China's managing it. We're not getting the inflation. At the end of the day, the Trump card could be gold. Going back on a gold standard, say $5,000 an ounce, it could be anywhere. It could be ranged. I've seen the estimates $2,000 to $8,000, but let's say $5,000 an ounce. And what does that do? Because it is inflationary at that rate, because of the dollar to 5,000, you're paying off your debt in tokens. In other words, we're paying off China in tokens. In effect, you've restarted the whole system. And I'm not sure that this is the scenario where we're heading, but I think this is worthwhile for us to recognize the possibilities and the potential. There's a whole lot of questions. There's a whole lot of reactions. There's a whole lot of responses. In that kind of a scenario, there's a whole lot of pain to really be involved in. But that's the picture I really wanted, really trying to put on the table here. This is part of the picture of the breakdowns element that we've been talking about for the last year. We've been talking about breakdowns, surprises, breakthroughs, the combination of all those in a soup pot of dynamism. Out of that soup pot of dynamism, we see shocks, one or many, and we see alternative scenarios of where the world heads. And I think it's important to recognize that in the financial and the economic realm and the risks involved in that and the soup pot mix and the possibilities that we're facing are ones to be awake to. Because we're ending up in scenarios that, as I've described before, we can keep kicking the can down the road, we can end up in a fragmented world, or we can begin to view and begin to manage and think toward the epical upshifts. How we get there, it's going to be a function of the systems. It's going to be a function of the complexities of the systems at play. But understanding them in the way that we really need to, recognizing that the systems are at play are in various stages of breakdown, understanding those, combining those with the varying perspectives and worldviews that we have and can understand, the consciousness at play individually and collectively, that's what's going to shape the future and the extraordinary change coming. It is that combination. So in the meantime, what we are in the midst of is educating ourselves, both outwardly, about what is involved in this transition, the new forms of living, the context that we're living to, and secondly, as we always know and we always end here on Zoomed, it's about the inward reflection and focus. It's about removing the barriers and roadblocks within ourselves to bring the brilliance to bear. In essence, there's a backdrop of care, concern, the nature of our own appreciation, our own development, our own engagement. That is our work. That is our cultivation. That is present-centered leadership in the world. That's what our conversation is about in Zoomed. Hope you have a great start to the new year. Keep this in mind. Have a great week. Enjoy, as always, like to say, we'll continue. More guests on the horizon. We've made a bridge here. More to come soon. Great to be with you again. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.